Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, does President Obama need congressional approval to step up military involvement in the Middle East? We will ask two members of the New York City congressional delegation, one who tends to be more hawkish, the other more of a dove. Also today, Wendy Davis, who became a national women's rights star for her filibuster in the Texas legislature to try to stop an anti-abortion rights bill. Now she has a book and is the Democratic nominee for governor, Wendy Davis, today. And WNYC art critic Deborah Solomon with her top 10 New York fall art shows list. But we begin today with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's been watching President Obama for, among other things, how he uses the presidency as a bully pulpit. Was his ISIS speech a good example this week? Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, is just out in paperback. Doris, so nice to have you with us again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, I'm always glad to be with you. Thank you.
Let me start with a headline, and we'll build out to some of the history in the book, if that's okay.
That's just fine.
How did you see President Obama's ISIS speech Wednesday night in terms of his use of the bully pulpit?
Well, I think it was a very important speech to make in terms of laying out where he saw the strategy going, what we were going to do, and finally saying, you know, to dismantle and degrade and destroy ISIS, because it wasn't clear whether the goal before had been containment or pulling them back. Once you get that goal, now there's lots of complications about how to reach that, but I think he made it an important first step, and it did get the kind of coverage that you would want such a speech to get. Oftentimes now when a president speaks, you know, he's on only a few of the networks, and you don't get the real sense of the speech, and people get only pieces of the speech, but I think this one broke through to a certain extent, which I think was important to lay the groundwork for this future involvement.
And listeners, we don't want to make this a debate over Obama's ISIS policy, but if you want to ask anything of Doris Kearns Goodwin about this book or any of her work or how she sees President Obama, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. In that context, Doris, callers frequently express frustration, and I know you've heard this from Obama supporters, that President Obama doesn't knock heads in Congress the way LBJ did, for example, to get his bills passed. They don't usually go as far back as Taft or Teddy Roosevelt, but they know about LBJ. Is it a fair comparison?
Well, I think the difference is partly temperament, that was what LBJ was born on this planet to do, to knock heads in the Congress and bring people together. He was a man of the Congress. He'd grown up in the Congress and the Senate, and he loved doing it. And I'm not sure that temperamentally that President Obama has that same joy in talking to congressmen and bringing people together. But the political culture has awfully changed since that time of LBJ. I mean, think of it. In LBJ's time, congressmen and senators would stay in Washington on the weekends. Across party lines, they would play poker. They would drink together. They weren't racing home to make funds for these escalating campaign costs. They had a sense of institutional pride in the Senate or in the House that surpassed sometimes their party and certainly the interest group pride that they now have today. And many of them had been in World War II together, so they knew what it was like to have a common mission across party lines, across racial lines, et cetera.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's really different in Washington. There's a tribal sense of anger at one another. They don't spend any time with each other. So I think it's much harder for a president to do what LBJ did. But also, LBJ was perfectly fit for the task.
You talk about the increasing tribal culture there. I wonder how you see even the 1990s compared to now in this respect. Remember that one of the reasons that President Obama got the nomination over Hillary Clinton was that people said, oh, the Clintons were such lightning rods, and there was all this mindless backlash against the Clinton impeachment on flimsy grounds and everything else. Obama doesn't have that baggage, so it's going to be a less reflexively polarized time. Well, ha.
Right. I think you're right. I think it began somewhere in the late 80s, 90s. I mean, think about the way in which the Clintons, you know, as you say, became lightning rods. Think about the way President Bush became a lightning rod, the second President Bush. So this has been developing, I think, over a period of the last 30, 40 years. and something's going to have to break the fever. I mean, you've got to have to hope that when people go to Washington, they go there because they want to get something done. I mean, even if they have disagreements across party lines, to not even take up the issues that are the central issues and just decide, well, we're not going to deal with them. I mean, that's somewhere along the line the country has to say, that's just not right, and get mad about it.
Doris Kearns Goodman with us on WNYC. Her book just out in paperback, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. And one of the comparisons you draw between now and Teddy Roosevelt's and Taft's day is the increasing concern with inequality and the concentration of wealth. That was the time of the great industrialists and the robber barons, and they were met by TR and others with the original progressive movement. Was there any analogy to Occupy Wall Street back then, or what lit the fire under a popular or populist movement?
Well, I think what made that progressive and populist movement work at the turn of the 20th century, when, as you point out, many of the items in the situation are similar: a massive gap between the rich and the poor, suddenly new rich people coming on the Industrial Revolution as they did with the technological and global revolution, people in the middle class feeling squeezed. But you had a group of reporters back then, the great investigative reporters, and that's why it's called, in addition to Theodore Roosevelt and Taft, the Golden Age of Journalism, who would create an understanding on the part of the public of what was wrong with why Standard Oil had become a monopoly on the backs of small businesses, why railroads were abusing their power to use their monopolies to undo small businesses, why the meatpacking plants were unsanitary, why the food and drug people were putting out fake medicines. And the people got excited and upset, and they pushed the old guard in the Congress to pass legislation along with Teddy Roosevelt's championship of the voice of the people. And it was that connection between the reporters and Roosevelt that really made a difference, I think, in the progressive era.
And we'll come back to the journalism piece and talk more of that, about that in a few minutes. But we have a rare piece of audio of Teddy Roosevelt himself. This is about 30 seconds from his independent run for the presidency in 1912.
Great fundamental issue now before our people can be stated with. It is, are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I believe they are. My opponents do not. I believe in the right of the people to rule. I believe that the majority of the plain people of the United States will, day in and day out, make fewer mistakes in governing themselves than any smaller class or body of men, no matter what their training, will make in trying to govern.
In trying to govern them, as the music creeps in, Teddy Roosevelt, 1912. And that was from a historical piece produced last year by Meg Luther of North Dakota Public Radio. She was also the founding producer of this program. But anything you hear in his voice or his content there that reflects what you're trying to communicate in the book about Teddy Roosevelt?
Well, I mean, what's so interesting is he's talking about two things at that time in particular. It was the day and age when direct primaries were beginning to be put into the election in various states, as opposed to conventions choosing the party candidates. So he was saying, we don't need these old political bosses anymore to do it. We want direct primaries. And at the same time, there was an argument that senators should be chosen not by state legislatures, where there was easy, you could buy a Senate seat for $1 million in those days in the state legislature, but a direct election of the people, which eventually becomes a constitutional amendment. But I think the sad thing to think about today, so we've gotten those changes, and we don't have the conventions choosing anymore. And then sometimes you look back at who the conventions chose as our leaders. They chose originally Teddy Roosevelt. They chose FDR. And who have we gotten recently? I mean, the primary system, while I think it's still a good thing that the people have much more say, it may have devolved into those crazy debates that we've heard, where people who don't even probably shouldn't be running are in those debates, and they get to look good because they say something bad about the other person. And I think our whole electoral system needs to be rethought today, just as it was in this time.
But when he says in that clip, the question is, are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I mean, I guess if we want to flip that into a contemporary context, we could say that would be an argument for a primary system rather than bosses or party leaders picking the candidates, wouldn't it?
That's exactly what he meant. No, that's exactly what he meant at the time. He was expressing his faith that better than having these political bosses have the determining
that is
the
what
people
you were
themselves
saying.
Should. No, exactly. Yeah. All I'm saying now is, you know, maybe there are changes in our primary system we have to work out, or in our electoral system, or the amount of money that's in the system, that if we are going to govern as a people, that we better figure out how to do it right.
One of the points of your book is to elevate the legacy of President Taft, not a household name these days, but one you say is underappreciated for his place in history as a progressive force alongside Teddy Roosevelt. Where would you begin to lay that out?
Well, what I hadn't realized until I got into this was that when Teddy came back from Africa after having really placed Taft in the presidency as his handpicked successor in 1908, he felt that Taft had betrayed his progressive legacy. And that was built on the thought that he had gotten a tariff bill through that wasn't as progressive as people hoped it would be, that he was somewhat drifting in the presidency and not moving forward along progressive lines. But really what had happened, in my judgment, is that he tried to follow Teddy's lead. The country had moved further than Teddy, further left in a certain sense, and he was distracted by the fact that his wife, who was his partner, almost Eleanor Franklin to Franklin Roosevelt, had had a terrible stroke 2 months after his presidency began, and the amount of time he spent with her meant that he wasn't the public leader that he could have been, maybe, or should have been. He actually did more antitrust breakups than Teddy himself did. So it's not like he's not disappointing the progressives at the time, which he absolutely did, but in history, I think, he's a fair, just, decent man who just maybe wasn't meant for a number two man to be the number one man and deserves more respect than I would have known when I started this project so many years ago.
And the contrast that you draw between Taft's and T.R.'s personalities is fascinating to me and has a contemporary echo. Roosevelt, always the active campaigner for change. Taft, with his more reclusive and judicial temperament, in fact, ending his life as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court after he was president, which you say was perfect for him. But even with that personality, Taft was able to lead progressive change?
Well, even with that personality, Taft was able, in the earlier positions when he was Governor General of the Philippines or Secretary of War, as long as he had somebody above him, he really could be the articulator. When he had to give a speech for Teddy, for example, he was great. When he had to do it for himself, he would slave over it and slave over it, wait till the last minute, and it wouldn't come out quite right. So it's different when you're working for someone else. When he finally became president, he said he felt like a fish out of water because it wasn't what he wanted. You have to have joy in politics to be in the presidency. It's what FDR felt. Somebody said to FDR once, why would anyone want to be president with all the difficult stuff you have to deal with? And he said, why wouldn't anybody want to be president? It's the greatest job in the world. And that joy, I think, was what was missing in Taft and really, in the end, undid him.
So are there echoes of that in the Obama temperament versus LBJ temperament conversation we were having before, you know, Obama, the cool and pedantic constitutional law professor that he used to be, as opposed to the fiery activist that his supporters wish him to be?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is I think it is true that judicial temperament makes you believe that when you lay out a decision and you give the reasons for it and the rationale for it, that should be enough. You don't have to keep repeating it over and over again. You don't have to go out among the people, you know, as LBJ would and certainly as Teddy Roosevelt would, and just knock it into their heads. And I think you do need to do that. I mean, one thing Teddy Roosevelt did so successfully were these whistle-stop tours where he would go around the country for weeks every spring and every fall, stopping in village stations along the way and talking in simple language that he himself said his Harvard buddies would think was too folksy. But it worked. The square deal absolutely summed up what his whole administration was about. Speak softly and carry a big stick. He even gave Maxwell House the slogan, good to the very last drop.
Really?
But he understood how to talk to people where they were. And I think sometimes coming from that judicial, constitutional law background, it's a different way of thinking. Although in campaigns, obviously, President Obama was right there. And sometimes maybe you just need the energy of the people before you rather than speaking from a teleprompter, which is why I wish he would get out on the train a lot more than he has done.
Doris Kearns Goodwin talking about yesterday and today, her book just out in paperback, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. 212-433-WNYC. And Deborah in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hello, Deborah.
Thank you. Yesterday, a commentator made mention of President Obama getting what he called bum's rush into Syria from his national security DOD establishment. And I want to ask about a historical comparison about Truman getting the bombs rush from Dulles DOD into Korea, and it took a five-star general, Eisenhower, to keep us out of Southeast Asia, and about President Kennedy determined to keep foreign policy focus on Moscow and Europe. Until LBJ, the master of the Senate, authored the greatest legislation of the 20th century, the Great Society, domestic policy, getting the bums rush into Southeast Asia and shifting foreign policy focus on Vietnam by March 1964. How would you compare the two if you agree with President Obama's getting the bums rush into Syria?
What a great question. Doris?
That's an absolutely brilliant question. You know, and I think the problem that presidents always have is that in the context of being in a room with military men who have experience, who know the world situation perhaps better than any individual president can, who've been there for a while, there is a tendency to rely on their judgment. I mean, I think President Kennedy learned that in a very good way in the Bay of Pigs when he relied on the judgment of the people around him to that disastrous intervention, and it helped him when the Cuban Missile Crisis came, because he then brought in other people around the table, including his brother, Bobby Kennedy, and decided that he had to make the decision on a whole series of issues, not simply military. You know, that's why I think even now we should have some sort of congressional debate about the whole question of what we're doing with ISIS. I was looking back to the sad, short debate that we had at the Gulf of Tonkin time, where I think it took place in the House only 40 minutes in 1964 and in the Senate 9 hours, to okay the president's Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which became the authority for the Vietnam War. Even for LBJ, he would have been better off if he had to go to Congress every year and debate this thing. The people he knew, maybe he would have de-escalated that war a lot more quickly if it weren't left to him and the people that were giving him the advice in the military.
But on the caller's premise of a bum's rush into Syria from his own national security establishment, it actually makes me think of your book, Team of Rivals, which came out at the beginning of the Obama administration, where you and others were celebrating him for the fact that he put Hillary Clinton in, who, of course, had run against him as Secretary of State, and other quote-unquote rivals, though they were Democrats. And now we see, maybe you watched that smackdown on CNN after the speech the other night between John McCain and the former White House spokesman for Obama, Jay Carney, where one of McCain's main points was that all of Obama's main national security appointees did want him to go into Syria a couple of years ago, and he resisted. So do you think that the Team of Rivals model has not worked as well as you thought it might at the beginning of the Obama term?
Well, I think there's two parts to your question. The substance of whether or not he should have gone in earlier or not, I honestly don't know the answer to. I mean, there's been so many different things written about whether it was not the right time to go in, the public wasn't educated the way they have been now after this whole terrible ISIS beheadings, et cetera, that the delay may have allowed him to gather more support for what he's doing now than he would have had 2 years ago. I don't honestly know the full answer to that. But I think the question as to the Team of Rivals not working as we might have thought it would, it turned out it was harder to do than I think we might have thought at the time. Yes, Hillary worked, and I think it worked for both Hillary and for President Obama to have that partnership. But if you may remember, he tried to get Judd Gregg, a Republican, into the Secretary of Commerce role. He accepted it first and then said, no, I really can't do it. And I think on the part of the opposite party now, it's considered a traitorous thing to be in someone else's cabinet compared to in 1940 when World War II was happening and we were not yet in it. FDR put in two top Republicans as his Secretary of State and War, Stimson and Knox. They disagreed with him about the New Deal, but they were with him on aid to the Allies. And they were even then, in opposition, their party said, what are you doing? But they did it. Nowadays, I think it's harder for somebody to cross those party lines. So you get people around you who may question your assumptions, but you don't have that same real argument that obviously Lincoln had by having all those factions right by his side day by day.
If McCain's take is true, and Jay Carney denied it, but I think there's been enough testimony by the people involved, Hillary Clinton and the former Defense Secretary Gates and others, that there was a rough consensus among his advisors, other than Vice President Biden, that something more should have been done in Syria, and Obama resisted a few years ago. Does that make you think of him as a stronger leader?
Yes, I think so, actually. No, I think if you hear the debate and you come up with your own decision. I mean, for example, even when Lincoln had all of his advisors around him and he was talking to them about whether to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, many of them said, don't do it now. Others said, you should have done it 2 years ago. And he finally stopped the debate and said, it's my decision, I'm doing it, and I don't want to debate the issue anymore. So, yes, I do think the fact that at that time, it goes against what we were saying before, that a lot of times these presidents are cowed by military advice. Here was a lot of military advice, and he felt the time wasn't right, the resources weren't there, and he made that decision after a rather large debate, perhaps. Now, making it differently now, he could argue things have changed, but I think it does suggest some strength to go against them at that time.
Raul in Prospect Heights, you're on WNYC with Doris Kearns Goodwin. Hello.
Hi. I've been very interested in groups like the American Association of Labor Legislation. It seems that there is a group between the reporters and the political leadership, this progressive movement that was cooperating together and providing not only a political basis and an intellectual basis, but also an organizational basis with voters and grassroots activism. And what do you say about that? What can you learn from those groups to today?
I think that's exactly right. I think those groups in the past have played a very important role in really educating the public and bringing the public to be mobilized on certain issues. When I think about the civil rights movement, for example, in the 1960s, you had the National Council of Churches, you had the UAW, you had the labor unions, you had all manner of organizations that were helping to mobilize the public. Not just the journalists that were out there, not just the congressmen that LBJ was reaching across party lines, but that layer. And I think those kind of institutions which have a social, progressive, in a certain sense, objective, are all the more important today if they're going to push through, you know, what seems to be a more difficult time to get progressive legislation through. I think you're dead right.
So why did you frame the book around the two presidents' use of the bully pulpit and the golden age of muckraking journalism? Were Taft and Roosevelt, as members of the government, somehow related to that journalistic activism?
Oh, without a question, Theodore Roosevelt would not have been the president we remember without the journalists, and particularly the group of journalists that I wrote about at McClure's magazine, because what they did is they created, through the stories that they published, which would often be 10,000, 20,000 words in the magazines, month after month, people were gobbling them up, talking about them. They created a common conversation. They created an understanding. Just take the trust issue, for example. It was so abstract. Nobody really knew what was so bad about these monopolies until Ida Tarbell writes about one monopoly, the mother of trust, Standard Oil, and people realized what J.D. Rockefeller had done to get his power. And it was unfair and illegal, a lot of the ways in which he'd crushed smaller businesses. So then they mobilized. We got to do something. And eventually Standard Oil was broken up. Eventually a Bureau of Corporations was created to look into monopolies. And you could say that about every piece of what the journalists studied, political corruption in the city, the food and drug issues. They created human stories that allowed people to understand what was going on in this big industrial era that gave Teddy the stories to tell. And his partnership with them allowed him to get the legislation through he never would have gotten through. It was key to his the bully pulpit was really the golden part of his presidency.
When you talk about the tens of thousands of words in those articles, just for context, folks, a New York Times column by Paul Krugman or David Brooks, who might be, you know, some public intellectuals of today hoping to influence the debate with their columns, that's 700 words. So a long article today is maybe a few thousand, so tens of thousands of words. Who was the audience for those pieces, demographically speaking?
Well, what had happened is it was a middle-class audience, and what made it special was that in those days, national magazines were pretty literary affairs, you know, the Atlantic Monthly or Harper's, and they were 35 cents a magazine, so it couldn't be, it was sort of an upper middle class. When McClure came along, he and then his followers made it 10 cents a magazine and sometimes 15 cents, which meant that the middle class was reading these things and they became a real source of public mobilized pressure. And as I say, they waited month after month. These magazines would sell out on the stands, and then they'd sell out in the subscriptions. They'd talk about them in their neighborhoods. And they were, one of the writers, Ray Baker, said, I can't believe they're reading these 10,000 words every week, every month, rather, and yet they keep coming. And then their series would be 12 parts. Ida Tarbell's thing eventually becomes a book. So does Ray Baker's. And the public discussion was the rule of the day at that time. I think today we're so distracted, and so much of journalism has become entertainment, and we're on blogs and Facebook and Internet. We don't have the time and attention to spend to an issue. And even when we do care about an issue, then there's a breaking news on something else soon thereafter, and you forget what it was that
Shark alert. But when you say middle class, and actually, are you still there, or did we lose your line?
Oh, I'm still here. Okay, I don't know what shark alert is. I'm here, I promise.
When, Shark Week, you know, comes and distracts people from what's important in the media. But when you say middle class, I mean, what, did 10% of American adults go to college at that time? So were these not college-educated folks necessarily reading these long literary pieces, or was there enough of an echo chamber in lower brow media for the long form articles to gather much popular resonance? You know, what was the sort of natural history of that?
I mean, very good question. I mean, the reporters themselves, many of them were college educated and probably the first in their generation to be so. But I think a lot of the people who read it would have been maybe not college educated, but maybe had somebody that they knew who was. Because it's bigger than just an elite literary market. And they've done studies of where it was. So I would guess that a chunk of them were college educated, but many of them were not as well. And there was an echo chamber that it reached down from where they were to somebody else.
I wonder if you see a similar era trying to break through in online journalism today, whether it's WikiLeaks the way they do it, or Glenn Greenwald amplifying Snowden, or Breitbart and his heirs on the right.
I do think there is. I mean, I think ProPublica is out there with investigative pieces, and the one benefit of the online world is that there aren't the same expenses involved, obviously, in producing a magazine, distributing a magazine. I mean, that was what McClure had managed to do at his time, figure out how to do it more cheaply so he could reach more people. But now that platform is there. So the question is, if the platform is there, how do we make sure that the people read it and then act on it, you know, and that goes back to that question about what are the groups between the journalism, the organizations, the associations that can somehow bring the news into a public sentiment that then forces Congress to take action on issues that people care about.
Interesting. Also, the tablet computer seems to be a long-form friendly medium compared to phones and laptops. People read longer stuff on iPads and Kindles, including, of course, books. So we'll see how long that persists or how far writers can actually take it. One more question for Doris Kearns Goodwin. John in Fairlawn, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Brian. Hi, Mr. Kearns Goodwin. I'm going to entitle this segment the baseball team of baseball rivals. Brian and Ms. Goodwin.
We're leaving the loser Yankees and the loser Red Sox out of it today.
Yeah, we're all on the outside looking in this year. Anyway, the question I have, because you spent so many years with your book subjects, could you tell me definitively what Abe Lincoln's voice sounded like?
Well, what we did know from somebody who was his partner is that he had a high-pitched voice, which is what Daniel Day-Lewis replicated in the movie Lincoln. And interestingly, when you were speaking to huge crowds in those days, a high-pitched voice was the best because it could go over the heads of the crowds, and you would sometimes have 10,000 people there. So we never heard it, but we know that, and we knew that he had a kind of an East Kentuckian Appalachian kind of accent from some WPA thing from some relative later on, and that's the best you know. But at least they tried to get as well as we could understand. I'd love to have actually heard it, actually.
Well, we did hear Teddy Roosevelt's voice on tape today from 1912, and we end with a description of Abraham Lincoln's voice from Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her latest book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, now out in paperback. We enjoyed it so much, speaking for myself and all the listeners who are calling and writing in. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Does President Obama need congressional approval to step up military involvement in the Middle East? We will ask two members of the New York City congressional delegation, one who tends to be more hawkish, the other more of a dove. They'll both be on together. Stay tuned.